The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Kick off the 2020 NCAAs on Wednesday, March 18th at the Barn at Cowboy Jack's in downtown Minneapolis. Presented by J-Rob Intensive Camps and Track Wrestling, the 7-7 pregame party will feature seven high-profile guests with connections to the wrestling community, including business people, entertainers, athletes, and coaches. Dan Gable, 1972 Olympic gold medalist, two-time NCAA champion, and 15-time national champion head coach, is the first booked guest. The full lineup of featured guests will be revealed via J-Rob Intensive Camps and Track Wrestling social media in the coming weeks. Event proceeds will be donated to Take Down Cancer, an initiative of the Randy Shaver Cancer Researching Community Fund. Shane Sparks of Track Wrestling and the Big Ten Network will serve as the event MC. Sparks will interview each of the seven guests for 7 minutes, the length of the collegiate wrestling match, mirroring the format of Track Wrestling's popular 7 minutes Q&A series. Come celebrate the sport of wrestling with friends while supporting a great cause. Tickets purchased online include a complimentary drink for those 21 and up. Ticket quantities are limited, so reserve your space now for this exciting kickoff party. And for more information, go to 7in7party.com and get your tickets today.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of Track Wrestling, along with the Frank Drebin of Track Wrestling. It's Andy Hamilton Files from the Police Squad. How are you, Andrew?
I'm perplexed. I'm totally perplexed. You've never what that
seen,
even means.
You've never seen Naked Gun?
Well, probably not in the last 30 years.
Yeah, well, I saw it the other night, and it reminded me of you.
How so?
Well, there's that scene where he is the umpire, goes out there, and then he does the dance, and he's calling strikes because the fans like it, and then he calls balls to keep the game going, and then Reggie Jackson comes out, and it just made me think, that'd be so cool if Andy was in that movie and was doing that stuff.
Are you saying that cool. I play to the crowd, Kyle?
Well, I think in that situation, if you had to save the queen, if you've seen the movie, I think that you definitely would play to the crowd.
Okay.
You absolutely would. I love, do you like Reggie Jackson, by the way? Are you a fan of his or
sure.
So-so?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yankee great.
Yeah. Don't identify him with the A's at all?
Nah.
Not as much?
I mean, he was an A, but you asked me about Reggie Jackson, I see him wearing 44 in pinstripes.
Give us your maybe 30-second take on this Astros cheating scandal. What do you think?
I'm pissed.
Are you?
I'm irate about it, Kyle.
You are? Take us through maybe just your psyche on this, and what do you think it's done to the game?
I mean, where do I start? You asked for 30 seconds. I can't go 30 seconds on this. Now you got my blood boiling
because you're
bringing
angry.
This up. Yeah, I'm mad.
But I think it's an important topic just because it's sports, and how do we make sure that we avoid this in other sports, cheating scandals? And I just would like
to know.
It's
just been one misstep after another. Like, I want to cut myself off here before I come off the rails, because you're hitting a hot spot right now.
Well, let's talk this. I've been meaning to bring this up, and I do want your take on this, is that on Track Wrestling social media, we posted, was Stephen Neal the greatest two-sport athlete ever? Of course, Stephen Neal, 1999 world champion in wrestling, two-time NCAA champion, made it to the Olympic Trials Finals in 2000 and again in 2001 for the World Team Trials. And then 10-year career with the New England Patriots, didn't play a down of college football, two-sport athlete, three Super Bowl rings, didn't do it simultaneously, but I think there's an argument that can be made that he is one of the all-time great two-sport athletes. And the reason I like his story is because he did it individually and he did it with a team. When you bring up other great two-sport athletes, I think Bo Jackson and Deion Sanders come to mind. Those were both team sports. To be able to do it individually and as a team, I think that really sets him apart from others. I would be interested with you, just Deion Sanders and Bo Jackson, what you think maybe separates them doing the baseball football thing and where you think Stephen Neal might fit in.
So I think Bo Jackson is the two-sport GOAT for me.
He's your number one.
Yeah, because I think He had Hall of Fame, legendary ability in two sports. And obviously, Stephen Neal was a world champion in both sports. And that's exceptional. Bo Jackson probably would have gone down as one of the great running backs in NFL history had he not had that hip injury, and that also sidetracked, derailed what would have probably been a Hall of Fame baseball career. I mean, he did stuff on the baseball diamond that was superhuman. That catch that he made in Baltimore where he was running full speed, ran up the fence, and that was unbelievable. He had superhuman power, like lightning bolt for a right arm, blazing speed. Like, that dude had it all. And fortunately, he suffered a hip injury and was never the same. But I think, like, this generation that's growing up now, if Bo would have been in his prime during today's culture with social media, like, people, like, he'd be trending on Twitter every time he took the field, whether it be a football field, you know, stepped in the batter's box, whatever. Never seen anything like him before.
We
were cheated out of, like, we just got a taste of Bo Jackson as a professional athlete.
Really is too bad.
Yeah.
Really is too bad. Of course, I have wrestling bias, but I truly do think that Stephen Neal deserves to be in the conversation somewhere. I just think what he's done is legendary. And again, I think what differentiates Dion and Bo is that they did them at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's really impressive. But what differentiates Stephen Neal is that he wrestled and didn't play a down of college football and then went on to his football career. So he went right in without having any experience other than high school going into the NFL. I think that's truly remarkable. And I hope people know about his story a little more. I hope heavyweight wrestlers and just wrestlers in general know about his story. And really what he did was absolutely remarkable. And I just think it's fun to have that debate on where he fits in. Another topic, and it's been brought up before, but it keeps coming to my mind, is just how wrestling has amnesia. And this is just people in general. We have a short memory on certain things. And I think we do have to pay respect to what Wartburg just did. The numbers are absolutely staggering. 220 conference dual wins in a row, 27 conference championships in a row. During that span, 14 NCAA championships. That just ended with a loss to Loras College, who the streak started with his dad. Jim Miller started it at Wartburg. Ends with TJ Miller, his son, who was 7 years old when the streak started. You can't make this stuff up, Andy. It's how that could happen, that TJ Miller breaks the streak, wrestled at Wartburg, and does it on the Jim Miller mat named after his dad. Like, that's just an ambitious Hollywood script at best. So what an amazing streak. Really tip of the hat to Wartburg. What an incredible program. Just like no other. They've done some incredible things.
Yeah, and they've gotten everybody's best shot here for 2+ decades, where they've been the gold standard, and we've seen programs rise up and challenge and then kind of slip back and then kind of take a step forward and look like they're maybe going to contend with Wartburg, and they don't quite get there. And then somebody else comes along, does the same thing, but nobody quite gets to the top of the mountain and takes them down until last Friday night. And it was, you know, terrific dual meet. And it took some kind of crazy circumstances within that dual meet to make it happen. You know, a guy like Clint Lembeck coming from behind, I think, down 3-0 in the third period at 141 pounds, gets a couple turns and wins a match there, you know, upset on in terms of rankings. And, you know, I think to go in and beat Wartburg at Wartburg, you got to probably win a match or two that you're not supposed to, or have something go your way that you can't quite predict. And so that was one. Getting a pin at 157 was big. You know, just really a tip of the hat to both programs, because what Wartburg's done, you laid it out, for 3 decades almost now is absolutely phenomenal. And then also Loras and what TJ and his staff have built there in a short period of time is pretty incredible too.
So you can look at it as 220 conference wins in a row. You could also look at it now that the conference since 1994 is now 1 in 220. And that to me just really, you shake your head when you put down a number like that. Like, the conference hasn't been able to crack this code. This isn't just one team. There's still teams other than Loras that haven't been able to crack the code until now. And boy, what an amazing streak. And it's not over. I mean, Warburg certainly can win the NCAA championships.
Well, the streak's over.
Yeah, that streak. But as far as what they can do, as far as winning championships, that's just,
yeah, you would think that somewhere during that period that there would be an instance where Warburg would have some injuries or illness or, you know, somebody's leading and they get caught and pinned and it sidetracks a duel. But man, 220 in a row is pretty mind boggling.
And I loved how you articulated and you laid out what Penn State just did. I think they need more recognition for what just happened. And again, I still think they have a real chance of winning the NCAA championships. But again, the amnesia thing, I think we forget too quick and we are really prisoners of the moment. And there were so many conversations for so many years, people asking, how is Penn State doing this? And the numbers really were jaw-dropping. I mean, what was the streak on the semifinals?
16-0.
16-0 in the semifinals. I mean, that needs to be brought up every year of how amazing that is and what Penn State was able to do. And even looking back there, and you brought it up before we were talking about what we wanted to discuss in the show. We're prisoners of the moment, but there is that vocal minority that probably throws shade a little bit more and you hear those people. But I can remember a couple years ago, people wanted to know, hey, Iowa was going to be the third best program and what's going on with Iowa and can Tom Brands get it done? And maybe Schwab should take over. I mean, just a lot of these narratives going on from some people, and you shake your head and you just say, Iowa has arguably been the second best team for the last decade, maybe the third. It could be Ohio State or Iowa. And can't you just recognize what they've been able to do with just an amazing streak of top five finishes? But nobody wants to look at it that way. So nobody really wants to dive into the numbers and appreciate what Iowa's been able to do with Penn State having a phenomenal run the last decade. I mean, it's truly been phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, we see it with other powerhouse programs that have taken a step back and finished some outside the top 10, some outside the top 15, and then they rise back up. Programs with national championships in the last 20 years that have had a season where they've taken a step back. Look at Iowa, what Iowa's done since year two of the Brands era. They've been in the top five every year. Remember, like, when they didn't win a trophy and people thought it was like a disaster that Iowa didn't win a trophy and it was, you know, a fifth place finish. They were a point or two away from, you know, they still had a chance to finish, I think, third that year, but up until like the bitter end. But we're in a competitive era where a lot of teams are investing a lot of resources. And I think just to put yourself in a trophy race year after year on a consistent basis is pretty impressive by itself. You know, and then you start looking at what Cale and company have done at Penn State over the course of the last 8-9 years, and it's been legendary. And we've only seen it one other time in the history of the sport. And for Iowa to rise up and be on top of a program like that, you know, tip of the hat to the Hawkeyes for that, and also for, you know, the other programs that have challenged Ohio State. You know, a couple of years ago, what a terrific NCAA championship battle between those two programs. And man, we're in an incredible period for the sport right now because dual attendance is off the charts. We've never seen it this high before. We've never seen programs investing in wrestling like this before. It's, you know, made it really difficult to contend for those top spots. And you see programs that, you know, we start to hype them up a little bit. And next thing you know, they're out of the conversation. And to be in the conversation year after year after year, I think there's a lot to be said just for being in the mix to win a trophy.
Yeah, and especially with Iowa's case, they've just never let themselves get out of contention. They're always right there. They're always relevant. And you see other programs that will dip down, maybe go into the teens, have a drop-off year. But Iowa is held to a higher standard. But I think sometimes unfairly, because they've been right there. They put out a great product. The fans continue to come. The attendance is constantly there. They're number one in attendance. You really do have to give credit. You've seen the adjustments that have been made with this Iowa team this year. Just the attendance is fantastic. The home dual meet schedule was off the charts, maybe the best ever, and truly mean that, looking at a historical window, to have that amount of teams come into Carver-Hawkeye Arena with those credentials and be that high ranked. You just have to really say this has been a great year for Iowa wrestling for home attendance, but they've done a really fantastic job. And you've heard it for the last couple of years. Tom Brands' narrative has been, we've got to get better at recruiting. And he's done what he wanted to get accomplished in those press conferences, talked about recruiting, how you get it. He's made adjustments and it's shown.
Yeah. Recruiting and then getting guys to open up and go out and score points. And two things have kind of gone hand in hand. They've gotten more elite level wrestlers coming in where it's, you know, they're not having to do as much development on the front end, maybe, as what they had to in the past. And so, you know, when you can line up guys like Lee DeSanto, Marinelli, Kemmerer, Cassiope, who can score an abundance of bonus points at, you know, all throughout your lineup. And then you supplement those guys with bunch of other guys, five other guys who are ranked in the top eight, their respective weight classes. And you got a team that has an opportunity to do something pretty historic this year, put up a huge number in terms of points if they can all 10 wrestle to their capabilities. And just eager to see what March brings for the Hawkeyes, and also if Penn State can, you know, mount a challenge and, you know, make the Hawkeyes really sweat this one out to the end, because I think they're capable, certainly. I mean, I don't think I think we should be crowning anybody at this point yet. Start looking at Penn State when you got five guys that are capable of finishing really high on that podium, scoring a lot of bonus points, and then they can supplement too. And they have some wild cards too. And you start talking about Brady Berge and Shakur Rashid. And we've seen in the past what those guys are capable of. If they can put it together in March, you know, we could have a really fantastic team race.
We have a couple of guests on this podcast. We have Joe DeSena of Spartan, and then we have Anthony Holman of the NCAA. We will talk about a couple different topics. Joe DeSena did not wrestle, but he's going to be at the 7-7 prior to the NCAA championships. It's in conjunction with J-Rob Camps and Trek Wrestling. That's going to be on Wednesday. And then we're going to talk with Anthony Holman about the NCAA championships in Minneapolis. And this is my first year going into the busiest week of the year on the track wrestling platform. All kinds of state wrestling championships, 15 different states on the track wrestling platform. You've been through this year with all of these great tournaments. I think there was one a couple years ago where it had all of the state championships plus World Cup, maybe plus a couple other things. But what's it like going through this, and how fun is it to have all of these great tournaments on the platform?
Yeah, it's awesome. It's a lot of work, but there's no shortage of things happening. As you alluded to, 2017, we had the World Cup streaming in Iran. We also had national duels that weekend. And the big Penn State-Oklahoma State duel that year in 2017 when they were Battle of Unbeatens down in Stillwater, and just a ton of stuff going on that year. I don't know that I've ever experienced anything like that. But this is a lot of fun because you see a lot of kids across the country realizing their dreams and, you know, being able to, like, the really cool part is seeing it on social media, seeing so many people post podium shots and bracket charts, and just a really fun time of year. And it's always been my favorite week out of the year is when state tournament season rolls around. And we're fortunate because we get to multiply this over the course of about 3-4 weeks in a row here.
And there's nothing like winning a state wrestling championship. It doesn't matter which state it is or what level it is. There's something that is absolutely magical about winning that state title. Some jump into the coach's arms and have different reactions, but there's nothing like it in sport, really, where you've accomplished your goal, you win a state championship, and you get to have that singular moment. And the opposite, too. There was an article, I think it came out last year, about the pain of placing second. And it was talking about a hallway of just some of the tears and the misery in a hallway. And so it really is a sport of contrast in that way, that you take it very hard and there's a lot of elation on the other side, but there's no real middle ground for that first and second place.
Yeah. I mean, for some people, making it to the finals is a huge accomplishment. For others, you know, making it to the finals and coming up short is something that sticks with them for a lifetime. And
the reason I'm laughing is because I think there, as soon as you said that, it made me rethink it. Because last year, a kid posted on his social media, he was cheering. I think he said, "Dude, didn't think I was going to cheer after getting second." And he was raising his arms, and it went viral, and a lot of people were retweeting it. So it was a pretty funny picture. So yeah, your point's well taken that can happen. And back to the amnesia topic, I forgot to mention Kyle Snyder. We have an interesting battle on our hands here at 97 kilos with the news that Jaden Cox is moving up in weight class. So I think everyone's excited about what the potential is there with two world champions. I just want to remind people this, we're talking about Kyle Snyder, the guy that lifted us to our most recent men's freestyle world championship in 2017, beat Sagulayev, three-time world champion, silver in 2018, bronze in 2019. And tell me if I'm wrong here, his only losses in world competition, Olympic trials, world team trials has been to Olympic champions.
You're correct.
So I hope people remember that Kyle Snyder is still really good, and don't crown anyone yet, because I think it's going to be a war at 97 kilograms. I just think it's I really do. I think it's a dead heat. I think to say one is favored over the other, I think that Kyle Snyder has proven himself and he has the track record. Jaden Cox is absolutely at the top of his game right now. Just his defense is legendary. As we've talked about, that's one of the drawbacks of having six weight classes. We don't get all these guys on there, but we do get to see these guys bang heads. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun with the Olympic trials being on track wrestling.
No doubt. It's something we've been talking about for 2 years, starting to project what the 2020 Olympic team would look like for men's freestyle. And it's the double-edged sword. You know, it's, you know, going to be a great thing that we get to watch these guys go heads up in state college, 74, 97 in particular, where you got world champs, multiple world champs in the bracket. After that, though, I mean, the downside is that a couple American greats, all-time greats, are going to get left home. You know, that's just a reality, but it's not like we're the only country. It's not like the United States is the only country that this is happening to. I mean, Russia is probably leaving, you know, multiple world champs at home as well.
Before we get to Joe DeCina, I also want to mention that we have the first ever, the inaugural Women's National Wrestling Championships, which will also be on track wrestling. I hope people tune into this to see history. It's March 6th and 7th. It's free, so why wouldn't you check in on that? So make sure to check that out and make sure you listen in to what Joe DeCina has to say. Didn't wrestle, but he has a lot of great things to say about the sport. We have a special guest today for On the Mat, and I'm excited about this because our guest, Joe DeCina of Spartan, is excited about the sport. And even more than that, he's excited, and he didn't even wrestle, and he probably loves wrestling more than anyone that I've heard talk about wrestling. Joe, how are you?
Hey, Dylan, it's true. I am a big fan of wrestling.
Why are you a big fan? I love it.
You know, met my wife. We bought a farm up in Vermont 20 years ago, 20 years now. And we started having children. And I had seen the movie Kill Bill with Uma Thurman, right? You guys have seen the movie.
Sure.
And there's a scene where she's training with a kung fu master. And I said to myself, wouldn't it be cool if we had a kung fu master living with us to train our children? So I went on a mission to find a legit Chinese kung fu master to come live with us on the farm. And I found one. And every day, every morning, he'd wake the kids up, you know, at 5:30 in the morning, train them. And then every night, 5:30, do 2 days, 7 days a week. And I felt like, this is fantastic. And at this point, I didn't have a lot of experience with, you know, combat in general. I just didn't know all the different disciplines. But, you know, everybody knows Bruce Lee. Kung Fu sounded like a badass thing for the kids to do. Anyway, I ran into a guy named Jay Jackson, who was a wrestler. He was one of the coaches at Stanford. And I found out his story, which is an unbelievable story, where his dad had him training blindfolded with his brother in the basement in the dark wrestling. And then I found out that many of the special forces, we became very close with the special forces through Spartan, that they look for wrestlers. And I started to think, oh my God, and then MMA, right? I found out, well, it's hard to beat, if not impossible to beat a wrestler. And so I said, I got to get into this sport. So we traded in the Kung Fu master for wrestling. And ever since, the kids are happier, grittier, tougher because of it.
You got to tell us about Spartan, because this is a really cool concept, cool organization that you've created. And a lot of it's predicated on the guts and the toughness that wrestling brings. This is your platform. Tell us about this great organization.
Yeah, so Spartan is 20 years in the making. I like to say it's a 20-year overnight success. And basically, it's a military-inspired obstacle race. You're jumping over walls, you're climbing ropes, you're crawling under barbed wire, you're going through cold water. It's really getting people outside their comfort zone, very much like wrestling on the mat, right? But it's outdoors, it's rugged. And for most of us in the modern world, I mean, we're in air-conditioned rooms, we got temperature-controlled showers, we got food on demand. We don't even go outside anymore. We don't talk to people anymore. We don't look people in the eyes. We're on devices. So this is like really novel, right? Like really unbelievable and so far out of the comfort zone to get outside and look people in the eyes and put down your device. And so that's what we do. We're in 45 countries, 275 events, 1.3 million people per year participate. And it is exactly what you would envision when I say military obstacle race, right? You're going through, over, under obstacles. And in the process, what ends up happening is you start to build something we call obstacle immunity. You start to change your frame of reference. Next time you're upset that Wi-Fi doesn't work on the airplane, you say to yourself, well, at least I'm not crawling under barbed wire. You've got reference points in your brain that you could reach to so that you could say to yourself, this thing that I'm dealing with in the moment is not that bad. Because I know what bad is. I know what hard is. Does that make sense?
Sure does. And with you saying that, what do you think holds people back from reaching their full potential?
I think the number one thing that holds people back is themselves, their own mind. They don't believe they can do it. They quit too early. They lose focus of what the goal is. It's a great story for those listeners to look up. It's called Will It Make the Boat Go Faster? And it's about an Olympic 8-man rowing team. By the way, while we're talking right now, if you hear a little noise, I'm pulling on my continuous rope machine. I don't like to do any phone calls without getting a little exercise. So I got my weight vest on and I'm pulling on this rope. I don't know if you hear it or not. I'm gonna try to do 2,000 feet while we're talking.
All right.
But anyway, this team, this Olympic team, this 8-man team, there was no chance they were going to win. They just weren't good enough. They didn't have the credentials. And the coach said to them, hey, listen, guys, for the next 18 months, here's what we're going to do. Every decision we make, we're going to ask ourselves, will it make the boat go faster? hey guys, great day today. Let's go get some Häagen-Dazs ice cream. Question, will it make the boat go faster? Answer, no, we're not doing it. Right? Hey guys, great week of training. Let's go out with the girls. Question, will it make the boat go faster? Answer, no, we're not doing it. And for 18 months, they define their lives that way. The only thing they let themselves do were things that were going to make the boat go faster. Sure enough, they won gold. And so I think when you ask the question, what holds people back from success? We all get distracted and we end up focusing on stuff that's not only getting us closer to our goal, but actually taking us further away from the goal, sending us in the wrong direction.
What was your upbringing like?
My upbringing was crazy. I grew up in a crazy neighborhood. If you saw the movie Goodfellas, I grew up in ground zero for that. It was all organized crime. Anybody who wasn't in organized crime was a true hustler, owned a family business, a pizza place, a masonry business, a cement factory, a cement plant. They were all up at 5 a.m. Everybody was always hustling money. Money was it. Everybody just focused on making money and getting ahead. Either that or eating pizza and cannolis and raviolis, right? But parents fought really, really ugly physical fights, ultimately divorced. And if it wasn't for my mom, who found yoga, health food, became a vegan, started meditating, if it wasn't for her pulling my sister and I out of Queens, New York, out of that crazy place, to Ithaca, where it was more sane and academic, you know, Cornell University in Ithaca. Lots of professors and professors' kids focused on the right things. I would have went in the wrong direction. I mean, I still got friends getting out of jail now after 25 years.
If you would have had wrestling growing up, how would your life be different right now?
I would have been a different kid. If I would have got into wrestling as a kid, I suspect I would have ended up in the military. I think I would have been even grittier, even more resilient. Hard for a kid to put on the singlet and then get out there in front of everybody. And, you know, it's all on you. There's no excuses. You win or lose. And I don't know. I didn't have that exact experience as a kid, although it was a tough neighborhood. And I think a lot of it was show tough. I think it's a lot more primal tough to get out there on the mat. So I don't know. I think I'd be a hell of a lot. I'd be further ahead and I'd be a lot tougher mentally.
Have you always gravitated toward combat and just that type of thinking that wrestling, mixed martial arts develops?
Oh, without a doubt. If it's the hard way, I'm interested. I think about the neighborhood. They weren't as tough as wrestlers, but they did shoot people. They did do crazy, stupid things. But yeah, that mindset existed. We're young kids, you're a product of your environment. But going hand to hand takes it to another level.
What do your kids say about wrestling now that they're in it?
They love it. They absolutely love it. They've had their moments when they get off the mat and they lost the match and they're crying. They really wanted to win. I always wonder, like, are they hurt? But it's never that. It's they gave it everything they had. They trained really hard and they lost. And it builds that ability. It creates that mindset of like, I don't quit. I dust off. I train harder. And I get on the mat again. And it's awesome. They got states coming up. So it's going to be interesting.
And then you have connections within wrestling. I think you know Rob Cole. And you stay connected with the Cornell program. Who are some of the people in the sport that you've built relationships with?
You know, I don't know a lot of people in the sport. Obviously, I know USA Wrestling. I know Dave Dean and his series of events and his partner Ed with I think he has RMN. So New Way and RMN, I know those guys. I know, thanks to Rob Cole, I know Cole. I know Kyle Dake. I know Yanni. I just got to know Andy Rovat. So yeah, I don't know a ton of folks, but there isn't a person, obviously Jay Jackson, who I mentioned earlier, there isn't a person I've met that I don't think is absolutely awesome. They're so humble. They're like gentle giants. Good people. It produces, the sport's incredible on how it molds folks.
Have you gotten down and rolled around a little bit and tested your mettle with wrestling?
I have. I'm embarrassed to say my toughest opponents are my sons. They, I came out with a black eye about a month ago. and I know punching's not allowed. Somehow with a cross face, I ended up with a black eye from my 12-year-old.
So they can take you?
My older one can take me. I'm embarrassed to say. Hopefully he doesn't listen to this, because I don't want him to know that. But I'm struggling with my 14-year-old for sure.
Tell us about your book, Spartan Up, A Take No Prisoners Guide to Overcoming Obstacles and Achieving Peak Performance. What can readers find in this book?
That book's really my story and this idea of changing your mindset and changing your frame of reference so that, you know, when I grew up in that neighborhood, I started a business at a young age in my preteens. And I was lucky enough to find some Eastern Europeans to come work with me. And they had a completely different upbringing than I had. They grew up in during the Cold War, and the walls weren't down yet. Communist, it was tough. And so when they worked with me, these young Eastern Europeans that had just moved to the States, when they worked with me, there was nothing that we did on a daily basis that was hard for them, because they had a different frame of reference the way they grew up. And so the book really tries to dive into this idea that, you know, our expectations are too high in the modern world, and our tolerance for pain is too low. And even if we have to trick ourselves and do some hard things, maybe sitting in a sauna, maybe rolling around on the mat, maybe doing a Spartan race, we do some hard things on a daily basis so that we could flip that, so that our expectations are lower and our tolerance for pain is higher. And that's what you find when you meet wrestlers.
So is this artificially creating values that don't exist? So let's just say it was the Great Depression. You had to be tough just to get through that, because you're probably battling hunger and you didn't have the income. Is this a way to overcome that with a very privileged lifestyle that we have in the United States?
Yeah, it's called manufacturing adversity. And, you know, if you and I were talking in India, in a really rugged city in India, I would say, look, the population here doesn't need to manufacture adversity. They have a tough life. If you and I were on Lewis and Clark's expedition, I would say, these guys don't need to manufacture, you know, adversity. They need a couch. But in this modern world where everybody gets a trophy and, you know, you can order stuff on Amazon and have it in about 3 hours delivered to your house, you don't have to read a map anymore. You don't even have to make a phone call anymore. You're like, shit, you don't even have to type a text, right? You could do a voice text. So in this easy world we live in, we need to manufacture adversity just so that we stop learning helplessness. If that makes sense. We are learning helplessness in this first world.
And you found that wrestling is an outlet to overcome that.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, and you know that, and all the listeners know that.
How about how you're going to incorporate the wrestling mentality in Spartan? Is there a way with your races to implement a wrestling portion?
We've had it. We have that annual death race, which is a crazy race. And I had a guy named Noel Thompson, who was coaching the club in New York, the New York Athletic Club, NIAC. And I had him come out, and the participants in one of the tasks obstacles. One of the obstacles was to wrestle him in the snow. It was awesome. The reality is, in our regular Spartan races, it would be hard to do because it's so subjective. We did it in Mongolia. We had a race in Mongolia, and I had legit Mongolian wrestlers out there in the field wrestling our participants. We got it on film. So when I get a chance, I do incorporate it.
What's the toughest thing you've ever done?
Probably the Iditarod. You know, the Iditarod goes across Alaska, the dog sled race. I did it by foot. And it was cold. It was 30 below zero. We were out there for, God, a little over 10 days, maybe even 2 weeks. And, yeah, that was really a test of my soul. And my eyelashes were frozen shut. I was absolutely miserable. You couldn't take your pants off to pee. It was that cold.
How about some ultra marathons? You like doing those?
Love them. Yeah.
Which ones have you done?
I've done a ton. I did Badwater, people might know, Vermont 100. I'm heading out next week to go something in Australia called the Hut to Hut. I love suffering out there. We put on a great ultra marathon in Pittsfield, Vermont. A 50 miler. That's just absolute hell. It goes through some parts of Vermont that are like Jurassic Park. So I love them all.
So if we went back to your era in high school, could we have read the writing on the wall that this is a direction that you were going to go? Did you have that in your DNA that you were going to reach a level that you're at right now?
I mean, I think we would have known. I knew that I was going to make money. I was going to be very focused on building a business. I don't think anybody could have guessed, certainly not me, that it was going to be around health and wellness and getting people outside their comfort zone. But when I think back to ninth grade, I did convince all my friends to leave school one day and play hooky and build a BMX course in a local park, which we got in trouble for. So I guess the idea of putting on some sort of events and building courses were just somehow in my DNA, because who does that, you know, in eighth or ninth grade?
And my understanding is you're going to be in Minneapolis for the 2020 NCAA Wrestling Championships. You're going to be part of the 7-7 that we're doing Wednesday night before the national tournament with J. Rob Camps and Track Wrestling. You excited to be part of that?
Very, very, very excited. Very honored. It's going to be awesome. I'm also going to bring Colonel Nye with me, who is a special operations colonel who I met when we were building Spartan. He helped connect us to the special forces. And he's a big wrestling fan. He was a wrestler himself. His son was a state champ. So he's also helping me navigate your world of wrestling. But I'm excited to be out there.
You're 46, right?
No, I'm 51.
You're 51. Okay. So you're
51 over the hill.
51. Gable is 71, I believe. Do you think you could take him even though you have 20 years on him?
If I had a gun, I could take him.
I mean,
without a gun, maybe a bow and arrow. If I had a bow and arrow, I might be able to last a minute.
Okay. Well, we might try to set that up. We want to give you something tougher than the Iditarod. We got to do it, man.
Oh, man. I'm afraid now.
We got to give you that artificial adversity. We're going to make it happen. But where are you with your rope climbs? 2,000 yet?
I'm only up to just under 900 feet.
Okay. Well, you didn't quite make it, but you made a great interview for us. Love the concept. Please check it out, Spartan.com. You're doing some great things there. Love your drive for wrestling. And if only other people could understand the sport like you do, I think that we'd have a universal appreciation. And thanks for sharing your enthusiasm with us.
Can I give a plug? We just built a new website called SpartanCombat.com.
Please do. Tell us about it.
I'd love folks to check it out. But the idea is to support, you know, the combat sports like wrestling, and start selling some cool gear, and basically just supporting that, you know, what you believe in, your lifestyle that we're talking about here, whether it's MMA, whether it's jujitsu, whether it's wrestling. So check out that site, and love some feedback, because we want to dive into that community.
SpartanCombat.com. We have been talking with Joe DeCina and really enjoyed this. Thanks for sharing your story, and look forward to seeing you at the NCAA championships in the Twin Cities.
Thanks for having me.
That was Joe DeCina. You can meet Joe DeCina at the 7-in-7 pregame party at the D1 Wrestling Championships, hosted by J-Rob Intensive Camps and Track Wrestling. That is Wednesday, March 18th, 7-9, Cowboy Jacks in downtown Minneapolis. Hope you'll be there. Just a small admission, $15, but there's going to be some fun stories there. Gable, Randy Lewis is always a good storyteller, so there's going to be a lot of people there, a lot of buzz, and glad that we get to be part of this. I think this is going to be a lot of fun.
I hope there's some J-Rob impersonators there, too. I mean, let's see if anybody can dethrone Pat Smith. Right now, he's the number one seed, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't know how he gets dethroned. Like, definitely not saying that's a lock, but I think you said that some others said that there were some people that were his equal, if not better.
I heard Brandon Paulson has a pretty good J-Rob.
I'd like to hear that one. I really would like to get a nice J-Rob imitation compilation. I think that would be a lot of fun. And Anthony Holman, you interviewed Anthony down in Florida in advance or during the NWCA convention.
Sure.
And I thought there was a lot of good information there. And I think we're going to get a lot of good information on what we can expect from the NCAA championships this year.
Yeah, I think Anthony is one of the most fascinating people in the sport to me, just because of his vision. And certainly, you know, I think we'll touch upon this later in the show too, but St. Louis, like, everybody was tagging St. Louis as the permanent home of NCAA wrestling for a long time. And I think it was at one point almost unanimous amongst the coaches that, you know, coaches vote one year in St. Louis, that's where they wanted to have it on a permanent basis. And you look at what has transpired here in recent years, the previous bid cycle where the tournament went to New York City and captured, I think, a larger audience out there, that maybe for a bunch of people that opened the doors for them to come to the NCAA championships for the first time. You know, a lot of people on the East Coast. And then certainly taking it to US Bank Stadium with the opportunity to put upwards of 40,000 people in the stands. I'm really excited to see how this pans out. And also, 2020 is a bid cycle. You know, we're going to later this year know where the NCAA championships are headed. Of course, we have Detroit and St. Louis coming up for the rest of this bid cycle. But, you know, there will be four more future sites that'll be unveiled later this year, and eager to see what Anthony has up his sleeve for those, because usually you can bet on one wild card selection out of this, and excited to see what that is. I'm really eager to see what's in store, whether it's, you know, a city that's, you know, we've never been to before, you know, and a potential new hotbed in the making. A lot of wrestling's really growing down in the southeast region of the country. Will it be taken down there? Will it go out west? Super excited to see where the NCAA is headed here for this next cycle. Is there anywhere in particular you'd like to go, Kyle, that
tournament hasn't been? Yeah, Phoenix, I think L.A., I think Las Vegas, I think Louisville. I think when we were in North Carolina, I think we felt like there were some opportunities down there.
Charlotte, yeah.
Charlotte would be great. I mean, I don't know what Florida has for venues, but Florida, Georgia, just some places where Atlanta, I think, could host it. So why not branch out and let people ask what's going on here? And that's the thing I remember about New York City is people stopping me asking what is going on right now. And they had no clue what was happening. And to be able to say it's the NCAA Wrestling Championships, I think, is a special thing. And it gets people out there. And I'm not saying it's going to turn people into fans, but it brings an awareness and it's a slow growth and you get people involved in it. And I just think that's a healthy thing. So maybe at one point, I don't want to, again, have my own amnesia. I think maybe at one point I would have been the guy that would have said, let's make St. Louis the permanent home. I am not that person anymore. We really do need to spread this out. And talking to Anthony, I think he's going to articulate reasons why.
How about Nashville? Nashville would be like the nightlife? How much wrestling fans would appreciate like the nightlife that would come with?
It'd be awesome.
And see a championship set?
Yeah, it'd be fantastic. Just the country music scene and everything that goes with it. So we've just whipped off a few there that I think would be really viable options. And I hope they explore them. I hope that we get a fresh place that allows us to really get in and dig deep and put some roots down for D1 wrestling.
I think the sport and the championships in particular have grown to the point where you can experiment a little bit, take it to a place that's a little bit off the beaten path as far as college wrestling is concerned. I think there's going to be that core that will go anywhere and everywhere that you put this thing. And then, you know, you have some other fans that if their team is performing well, they're going to hop on. But then also, if you put it in a place that is a touristy type of location where, you know, there's some other things that go with it, and certainly warm weather, that's not going to hurt either. But man, I'm excited to see what the NCAA has in store here for this tournament. And, from 23, 24, 25, and 26, if I'm not mistaken.
We're in the best times for the sport, and let's bring in Anthony Holman so he can tell us why. Our second guest for On the Mat is the managing director of the NCAA championships, Anthony Holman, and the man that's going to make our dreams come true in 2020 at the NCAA championships. How are you, Anthony?
I'm good, Kyle, and yourself?
Well, I'm excited. I'm excited about the potential of making history. And can you give us an update on what this is going to look like in Minneapolis? We have the NCAA championships coming up. How's it looking right now?
Yeah, no, I'm glad to hear you're excited. We certainly are as well. Ticket sales are going well, continue to progress our team allotment was slightly less than what we anticipated. But I think that was, or the number of tickets our institutions took based on what we were holding for them was less than what we were holding for them. But I guess I'm not completely surprised, because we had so many more opportunities for the general fans to buy tickets in advance. And that's normally not the case. So typically, you know, that demands a much higher coming through our school. So we've made up that ground and then some through just our general outreach. So that's on the ticket sale side. But the other part that we're really excited about and probably even more excited about is just the ability to provide a more, I would say in many cases, an enjoyable experience for our student athletes. And by that, I mean, you know, oftentimes those guys are fighting for space to camp out, you know, to put a pillow, a sleeping bag or an air mattress, or, you know, somewhere to have some nourishment after matches. And we really won't have that problem for them this year. We've got plenty of space to allocate. We've got plenty of locker room space and all of those types of things. So I think it's just going to be really enjoyable for our student athletes. And add to that the experience for our fans with more entries, more restrooms, more concession stands, larger hallways, all of those types of things that you don't often think about unless they're not pleasurable. But I think that they're going to be really, really positives for this championship.
Anthony, do you have a ballpark number on how many tickets have been sold to this point?
About 36,000.
And that's less than what you wanted?
Well, I mean, it's less than what I anticipated, because I had assumed that our institutions would take, again, on average, we hold about 10,000, 11,000 tickets for our institutions. But, you know, in recent years, the requests for tickets have been around 15,000 from our institutions. So we've had to cut in many cases, the allocations to our institutions by, you know, 30-40%, in some cases 50% in some years. So we elevated what we were holding. So if it on average had been, you know, 15, we held about 17,000 seats for our institutions, and they ended up taking roughly about what they have historically been taken or been afforded the last couple of years. So around 11,000 tickets. So we had, you know, 6,000 tickets that we had intended for to go to institutions, but that they did not claim. But that's a good thing, because that means there's lots of quality seats, great seats still available for our fans. And for the first time in, oh man, a great number of years, at least in my tenure, that we are selling single session tickets and actively promoting it, because we want, you know, we want the casual fan or the person who can't commit to, you know, 3 days and six sessions, but we still want, they still have an interest in coming to the championship. We want them to be able to do that and at a very reasonable price to come out Thursday morning or Friday morning or even, you know, Thursday night to check out a session, see what this excitement's all about without having to make a larger both investment and time commitment.
What does it take to pull off an event of this magnitude? It's going to set the all-time record. What does it take?
Great wrestling. First of all, I mean, don't kid. I won't kid myself or get too high and mighty. I mean, I think certainly I've had some ideas, and having not been a wrestler and coming from different sports and viewing this differently, certainly it pushed the envelope a little bit. But none of that happens without the quality wrestling. So first and foremost, it's the product that we're providing. Second is the platform. You've got to have a venue and a community and a city and a host institution. All of those pieces come together to work together to put this on. There's so many moving parts. You know, we're going to have 300 plus volunteers to help put this thing on. And, you know, I just finished a 2-hour call with our host committee and our staff here, working on logistics and everything from, you know, what we're shipping hydration products to how we're going to set up the lounges for the student athletes to who we're securing to be award presenters and weight class escorts to meals to ground transportation to security, you name it, everything, you know, all of that and more. So it takes a lot of collaboration through a lot of different folks and a lot of different entities to put it on. And we're fortunate to have good partners, at the University of Minnesota, who, they know their wrestling and they are good partners in the city. And the city has been great to us as well. The folks at Sports Minneapolis is, you know, when we broached the idea of maybe going to a stadium, and I shared that with Matt Menier several years ago, he said, you know, that might be something we'd be interested in. And it just kind of took off from there. So we're grateful. But yeah, that lots of moving parts, lots of people involved.
Obviously, it's going to be a different look, NCAA championships, and not going to be eight mats jammed together. What will the mat layout look like inside US Bank Stadium?
Yeah, so that's been a pivot a little bit as well. Again, because my initial vision or thought for this was, hey, here's a great opportunity for us to do something different, right? So we've got all the space. So we played with a number of iterations, some diamond shapes, some, you know, parallel, some kind of just a linear look. And inevitably, we realized that what we typically have is still the best layout for this facility. So we'll have a 2x4 mats, 2x4, two across and four long in the stadium. But unlike in arenas where the mats are butted up together and we're tight and we're taping them together, we're going to space them out. We'll have probably 8 to 10 yards between each mat. So that'll be great. Give us lots of space. It's going to afford us an opportunity, for photographers to have access to mats on both sides, as opposed to historically just shooting from on the ends. So probably will give some better photo opportunities there for our photographer friends and media. Certainly going to provide more space for our wrestlers to maneuver. It'll provide more space to move our scores tables off the mats that provide, you know, for a better quality experience in terms of safety and viewing, because now, you know, folks who potentially have had an obstructed view by a table worker because they were so close to the mat, you know, that depth perception, that moving them off the mat helps with that. So think of that. So the setup, to answer your question, it's still going to be in the 2x4 format that you historically have seen when we're in the eight mat format, but they won't. They'll just be spread out a bit. Yeah.
What kind of feedback makes it to you? So, for example, I think the last couple of years you hear people complaining that the venue wasn't open early enough. It might be open an hour before, and then of course you have security checks. Is there a way to resolve that? And is that an issue that even makes it to your desk?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah, it makes to my desk, and most issues do. But I want to. I say that not tongue in cheek. I say that because if we don't know about it, if we're not experiencing that, it's difficult to then be reactive to it. I will tell you that there are a number of things that go into how you decide on when you're opening gates and things like that. So typically when we're at arenas, if that's their normal protocol, we oftentimes fall in line depending on what city you're in, what the union labor requirements are, what those protocols are. Even 30 minutes can add substantially to the cost of operating a championship. So that's been part of it. There's been some concern around traffic flow and other things. So I guess I share all that to share with you. Yes, those we consider those things or other factors, but we have heard loud and clear that over the last several years that at least on the first day, there seems to be this angst and this real urgency of fans to get there and get in and find their way around. So we've made an adjustment on our gate time. So all of our gate times this year will be 90 minutes beforehand. Another factor that that we had to consider previously was that technically our weigh-ins have to be held privately. So you can't trying to open the gates too soon where we're having guys weigh in that, in just, you know, shorts, no tops, and pretty skimply dressed, letting the fans and the general public in during that time wasn't an option for us. So you can't let them in too soon because we were doing weigh-ins on the floor. Well, we didn't have anywhere else to do weigh-ins for 330 guys. Well, now we've got more space. So all of those things factor in and provide, again, another reason why being at a stadium is really a positive thing, because now we've got more entry points, more security in terms of scanners and magnetometers and things like that to get people through quicker. And we also have the ability to open the doors sooner because we don't have to be concerned about weigh-ins in the morning. So yes, we heard you, fans, and we are reacting to that. And hopefully this will be a better experience for you.
You cover and coordinate a lot of NCAA championship events. Compare wrestling culture to other cultures that you have to deal with.
Oh, boy. There's no other sport that I've worked with that I've encountered that has a fan base that is more committed, loyal, enthusiastic, knowledgeable, engaged. As wrestling, it's incredible. You know, I was a basketball player in college and knew very little about wrestling. I had a couple cousins in high school wrestle, so I'd gone to a handful of wrestling matches in my life, but nothing prepared me for this. And I ran our D3 championship for a couple years, and even at that level, it was incredible. Just the support that the fans provide to this sport and this championship, it's been amazing, and we're really grateful and thankful for that support. And part of that we hope that we're able to showcase this wonderful championship to even more fans and grow that same type of appetite and excitement for the championship around from other folks. So yeah, we're really fortunate in that respect.
You know, as Kyle alluded to, you've overseen a lot of different sports, including hockey and College World Series, volleyball, lacrosse. What have you taken from what you've learned from those sports that you've helped apply to wrestling?
Yeah, I think the biggest two things is the first is remembering who we're doing it for, and that's the student athlete. So keeping that in mind, what can we do to improve their experience? What can we do to make this feel special for them? The one. And then two, this may be the only time in terms of fans, this may be the only time this person sees this sport, has an experience at this venue. What do you want that experience to be? So I share with, you know, I keep that in at the forefront of my mind. I share that with our staff as we do our planning. And oftentimes, you know, like you said, you know, we've had troubles with, especially in the first session with folks getting in or long lines for restrooms or troubles with parking or, you know, any number of things. And I hear about those things and that's disheartening because we don't want that experience. We don't want fans to leave with that experience. So we, you know, that is something that I take from every championship that we try to do better. And you can borrow, steal even from other championships. A couple of things we did at lacrosse around fast pass lanes and other things like that, you know, was a byproduct of something we had done at College World Series. Or, you know, so you borrow and you share and you do what you can to enhance championships as best you can. Wrestling certainly is unique because there's no other championship that has, you know, this number of individual institutions and then individuals that are competing, and the weigh-in component creates, you know, is certainly unique. While we've got a lot of competitors at track and field and swimming and diving, you know, the weigh-in component creates it's a different animal, and the space requirements needed in an inside venue to do that, it creates a different challenge for us as well. So, but back to your question, what those are, you know, the experience for the student athlete and the fan, the consumer are the two focal points that we always try to strive or to keep at the forefront in all of our planning.
You know, Anthony, we had an opportunity to talk down to Fort Lauderdale at the NWCA convention and talked a little bit about bid cycles. And you said that, I remember you saying February was a date maybe that you guys kind of whittle it down a little bit and determine how many viable options. You thought there would be more viable options for 2020 with this being a bid year. How many, you know, ballpark do you have that, you know, cities that are interested in this tournament that you look as potential matches?
Andy, I'm going to get in trouble because I don't know. I know I've not gone through all of our bids thus far. I've cursorily looked at a couple of them because I had some conversations with them. I can tell you that last bid cycle we had as many as 18 in 1 year. I know we have more than that in a given year, but I've only looked at the 23 year right now. We have about, I know it's more than 18, so somewhere in the neighborhood of 2021. So, but how many of those are viable? Again, we've just started that kind of process of kind of working through that. But I will tell you that I fielded dozens of calls from places that I wouldn't have thought 4 years ago, you know, 6 years ago, they would have been interested in or would have been a good fit for us. But that's just a testament to the championship, to the young men that wrestle, the coaches that prepare them, the support staff that supports them, and what wrestling has is and continues to be. It's a special championship.
you've, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, the, you know, a wild card type of site you've come up with in each of the last two cycles with Madison Square Garden, taking it to New York City in the previous one, mm-hmm. this one in US Bank Stadium, going into an NFL stadium. What are some things that, you know, long-term visions you might have for where this tournament could go, what you want to accomplish?
Yeah, wild card. That's a good one. Don't let our coaches hear that one, because the wild card meetings used to be something crazy. I'm glad we don't do that anymore for D1 wrestling. But anyhow, that's been intentional. We made a concerted effort during the last bid cycle and this bid cycle to identify seven kind of really important principles and around for the wrestling committee and the championship that we thought were important to help guide the decisions. And part of that led to the selections of these unique places or wild cards, if you will, of places that were non-traditional. And again, that was intentional because we wanted to grow the sport. You know, typically we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 87% to 90% repeat attendees. So I spent a number of years in professional sport, and we would kill for those numbers. That's retention, right? So those are your season ticket holders, and what a program you can build if you've got 90% retention rate. Well, for us, while that's a great thing, it also meant, though, that we weren't introducing the sport or the championship to any new fans. So in order for us to do that, we thought one of the ways to do that is go to new markets, one, or two, go to larger facilities and provide those opportunities. And that's how we've landed in New York and Minneapolis, respectively. So I think, knock on wood, if this goes well in Minneapolis, I anticipate that we'll have a similar strategy going forward. That doesn't mean that we'll be at, you know, NFL stadiums, you know, consistently. I just think it will be, the mindset will continue to be that way. What can we do? What's a market? What's a venue? What's a city? What's a location that might provide us an opportunity to do some of those things?
You know, I think maybe in the past, like, you know, at least from my vantage point, it seems like the tournament has gone to locations where wrestling is strong traditionally, and, you know, St. Louis, Iowa City, Oklahoma, going back, you know, I'm going back 15, 20 years, but it seems like now maybe is the sport healthy enough? Is this tournament healthy enough that it can succeed in places that maybe are non-traditional wrestling locations and help wrestling grow in those locations?
I think so. And that's certainly something that we're banking on. This was, you know, as if you're planning for retirement, right, your investment broker, or your financial planner says, hey, what's your risk level? Is it, you know, high, low, moderate risk? I think this being in Minnesota was, and being at an NFL stadium was moderate risk. I say moderate because, yeah, it's at a much larger venue, but it's still in a location or region of the country that supports wrestling, and it supports it at a high level. So I think it mitigates some of that risk. Yeah, it's a much larger venue. There's some risk you take about alienation if folks are not open to change, or if you can't duplicate that experience, but it's that's mitigated by the opportunity to introduce it to so many more fans or so many more people. So I think I share all that to share that I think if we can do it in that sense, wrestling certainly is strong, and the championship, I should say, is strong, but, you know, we're not seeing a whole lot of growth in Division I programs. We are fortunate to have great support for the programs we have, and those institutions and fans have been really loyal and have shown a propensity to travel and support it. But when they don't, as long as we're somewhere where there is also an opportunity for new fans to come, I think that's the that's a blueprint, if you will, that we would hope to follow in the, at least in the near term.
We are about a month away from the NCAA championships being in Minneapolis. Does it feel like you're in a sprint to the finish right now?
It did today. After I was on the call with our host and the venue and some others, and we're like, oh boy, we feel like, you know, we've been working on this for 18 months, 2 years almost, but there just is always something. There's always more to be done. So we are definitely got our running shoes on, and we're in a full off sprint now. And you got to keep in mind that running the championship is one part of it, but we still gotta help support conference championships, and then we've got to have selections, and we've got to still a lot to be done before we land in Minneapolis.
So that week and the actual tournament itself, what's it like for you? Are you just nonstop the entire time?
Yeah, but it's not just me. You know, we've got a great number of people who really work really hard to make sure the event's successful. But yeah, so starting from on Monday of the championship, when we get there and unload mats and start setting up and getting ready for registration and all of those types of things, and helping teams with transportation and hotels and officials meetings. And, you know, we go pretty hard. It's, you know, 16, 18 hour days pretty much for that week. And, it's a grind, but it's a good grind, and it's all worth it. Come Saturday night, when, you know, we turn the lights down and those guys run out and to screaming fans, normally 19,000. Now it's going to be 40,000. That'll be special, and it'll certainly be worth it. I'll sleep after.
You said that your children wouldn't even want to talk to you for 20 minutes. We've gone over that, but every YouTube video I see a Lisa Holman saying, "That's my dad." So it seems like she's pretty proud of you.
Yeah, that's my baby girl. So I'm pretty proud of her too. So it's mutual.
Thanks for this time. This is going to be a lot of fun. Can't wait for the NCAA championships in Minneapolis. Thanks for sharing some insight, and we look forward to seeing you up there.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
All right. When I hear an interview like that, the first word that comes to mind is pragmatic, and then maybe calm. I think he has the disposition to be able to pull this off. I just like the way he executes himself in interviews and just how he's able to articulate what it takes to pull off a championship event, and some behind the scenes there that I just wouldn't have thought of, just like the weigh-ins and some of the positional challenges of where you have that and letting fans in early, and some of the things that I certainly didn't think of when I was a little upset standing in line. So he articulated that. It sounds like the problem will be solved. They're going to open 90 minutes before, but some really good insight from Anthony Holman.
Yeah, I like talking to Anthony. I think he's an innovative guy. I think that probably, you know, we've talked about it in past shows that there was a period of time where a lot of push towards just making St. Louis the permanent home of the NCAA championships. And, you know, they took it out east and took it to Madison Square Garden, and boy, like attendance figures. I don't know if it's because of the NCAA championships going to Madison Square Garden and more fans, but, you know, a lot of programs along the East Coast are drawing like crazy right now. And across the country, we've never seen dual attendance like this.
Haven't seen dual attendance, and no matter what, with this turnout, we're going to set a record for the NCAA championships based on the ticket sales, but no matter what gets said, so if people walk away and say, "I don't like it," I don't think it really matters when you're trying to push the envelope, and that's what they're trying to do. And I hope people will have an open mind about that, that in order to make progress, it might not be the comfy cozy what you're used to. And I like that. I like that they're extending the boundaries and, what was his term, calculated risk or moderate risk. Sure. And I think with this, give it a chance. Let it play out, and when you're going to set records, it might not be what you want all the time, but I think there's going to be some real positives that come out of this. Just give it a chance.
Well, yeah. I mean, remember, it used to just be on college campuses.
Yeah. It will never be again.
Yeah. And now it's gone to, you know, seemingly like, you know, here in 2013, what it was in Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines, and it holds like 16 and change. And it's almost like now 20,000's the threshold just to get you really in the conversation for this event. And we're going to have 36,000, maybe 40,000 plus up at US Bank Stadium. And think about, you know, what happened with NCAA basketball for a long time. That was in smaller venues. The Final Four was held in 15,000 seat arenas. And now they're putting, 70,000 into the stands with regularity.
Yeah, it's fun to see the progress. And progress isn't always necessarily neat and tidy, but we're seeing that. And as you alluded to, just some of the numbers that we could go through with Penn State, Ohio State, Iowa versus Penn State, just some massive numbers that have taken place this year. And maybe some of the smaller programs aren't getting that quite yet, but I think it's coming along, and I think you're seeing a product that really is viable. And the more we can have conversations like this, and I think the more talking points we can have about a fun, not a fun venue, that's a bad word to use, but just a venue that is outside of what we would traditionally think, in what you said, just a non-traditional wrestling area like LA or Las Vegas, maybe Phoenix, go somewhere like that. Let's try
Nashville.
It out. There you go. That'd be awesome. I think any of those venues, and what did he say? He said that the wrestling fan base is like no other. They will come. It really doesn't matter where it's located. Just what Jim Gibbons has always said, you could have it in Alaska and people are going to show up to that thing. So I think we're in a good space right now and can't wait to see what this is going to look like. It's in a football stadium. Mm-hmm. This is going to be unbelievable. Any final thoughts from you, Andrew?
No, Kyle, just looking forward to this week. It's my favorite week of the year with all these state tournaments coming up. It's 17 of them on track wrestling this week. And, you know, the Division I season ramping up towards, you know, a fun finish. Same with all the other divisions in college wrestling. You know, postseason is here, and man, it's the best time of year. Of course, over the course of, think about what we got coming here in the next 6-7 weeks. I'm here to the Olympic trials. It's going to be awesome every week.
And your 44th birthday coming up. So that's exciting too. Oh,
that's awesome.
That's going to be awesome. We're going to celebrate all of that. And don't forget the 7-7 party. We had Joe DeCina on earlier. It was great to talk with Anthony Holman. As always, for Andrew Hamilton, I am Kyle Klingman. You have been listening to On the Mat.
Is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network. For more wrestling podcasts, head over to matttalkonline.com.